talk.
Well, thank you for the invitation to speak here. I'm going to be talking about the invention, the development of semiconductor laser from the very early days to the most modern, the development like quantum cascade lasers. And I think, as Joe Jordan said, this is the laser had the greatest commercial impact. And I think it is important to realize that it was done in a constant of convergence of different fields in highly interdisciplinary type of environments, primarily at industrial and government labs such as Bell, GE, IBM, and so forth, including of course the Offa Institute, which led to revolutionary device advances. So the various era of fields are materials research, and in particular the emergence of modern films growth techniques such as MBE, ALCHO and R2, MOVP by Manasevich and Dupuy later, with the unprecedented control of composition, interface abruptness, layer thickness doping. These are the growth platform of essentially all semiconductor laser, at least the majority of them. Of course, the first one were made by liquid phase epitaxy. The other sort of intellectual thrust is solid-state physics and solid-state electronics. Let me remind you that as late as in the 40s, Wolfgang Pauli used to call semiconductor physics dirty physics. Later on, Sheldon Glashow used the equally sort of non-kind words for solid-state physics and so forth. But I think through the convergence of major discovery in solid-state physics and the tremendous impact of technologies that largely changed by now, so we have laser action in PN junction, injection laser in 1962, then the revolutionary impact of semiconductor heterostructure, the understanding of optical and transport properties, first proposal of the heterojunction laser concept, 1963, and finally the great milestone at the Offa Institute and at Bell Labs of the CW room temperature laser. The other in intellectual thrust is that of band structure in engineering, basically design material with man-made property, which we can be designed bottom-up using the laws of quantum mechanics, quantum size effect tunneling, super lattices. So, of course, the pioneering paper of Saki, Tsu, and Chang, and the work at Bell Labs, which led to quantum cascade laser and more recently to QCLs. So I call this a discovery because it was very sort of, the idea was basically there. In some sense, it was considered obvious. Now, we have to be careful with obvious because I look back, in fact, the first idea that a PN junction could lase under applying current was discovered in the notebooks of John von Neumann. John von Neumann, yes, the same one von Neumann of computer, chemical reactors, the density matrix, and so forth. And later it was realized that you don't need external mirrors, you can just cleave it. And in 1962, almost simultaneously in four different laboratories, this was achieved. And of course, they were homojunction. They operated only in pulse mode and a high threshold because of lack of carrier and photon confinement. The introduction of the heterojunction in the operation of a semiconductor laser, which led to the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2000, at least part of it, has revolutionized these lasers and made very important for communication. This, in fact, I borrowed from one of the slides that Cromer showed at his Nobel lecture. And you see the key of the heterostructure, the interface is the device, in a sense that it allows to independently control the electron and the whole motion. And this changes the nature of the game. So in a heterojunction laser, by putting a low band gap in center and wider gap here, you can confine both photon and actually carriers. That reduces the threshold in a dramatic way. Otherwise, you simply cannot get CW at room temperature. There are many other advantages of having heterostructure, particularly when you put quantum wells in the active region. You can reduce the so-called chirp of the laser, change of wavelengths. Let me call this in a somewhat provocative way. This is a bit now the old, still very effective, you know, the gallium nitride laser is a beautiful story for the blue, is an old way of generating light. As successful as it is, it runs into a major problem. If you want now to make a PN junction, a heterojunction laser that works at very long wavelengths, like mid-infrared and so forth, because basically the quality of the material is not there, that's one reason. And second, as the band gap shrinks, the operation of the laser becomes very sensitive to actual temperature. So as of today, in fact, certain of these materials cannot yet lase at room temperature. So it's very different. So I was aware of this when I was working at Bell Labs, but it wasn't the main motivation for the quantum cascade laser. But to set the tone, we are now looking for a new type of laser that can cover essentially the whole mid-infrared region, possibly even the terahertz region. There is a Restalin band here that where you cannot propagate light in polar semiconductors. And until the advent of the QC laser, it's fair to say that has been sparsely populated by wavelengths, but the application can be huge if you can get not only cover most wavelengths, but let's say, can you make a widely tunable semiconductor laser? And in fact, what the quantum cascade laser, essentially it eliminates what is so-called the band gap slavery, the fact that you need both electrons and holes to lase, therefore you need to lase across the band gap. In a QC laser, it's very much more like an atomic laser. In fact, this you can call it a four-level laser because you lase between excited state, confined quantum state, in the same band, as opposed to an interband transition. So the key point, as long as you have deep enough wells, you essentially control the wavelength primarily by changing layer thickness. So using a material system like alloys of 3-5 semiconductor, you can cover a tremendous range just by controlling the thickness. And the key point now that you can achieve laser action in the mid-infrared and in the far-infrared using the state-of-the-art epitaxial material, gallium arsenide and indium phosphide base that are used for telecommunication and other application at shorter wavelengths because you are using a different laser principle. And in fact, the QCL right now is starting to cover a major part very successfully of the mid-IR and going into the terahertz or far infrared. And I came to it, I was at Bell Labs then, it's kind of interesting. I did my PhD with Professor Francesco De Martini, who had worked with Charlie Towns, and so my youth was very full of MIT stories and so forth. But then he encouraged me, said to Federico, leave non-linear optics and lasers because the field is saturated. You know, there's just too much. Go and do something else. So, great, my great professor, sure. I went into actually fiber optics. Then I got a fellowship to study at Bell Labs, and sure enough, I took the advice very seriously, so I started to study transport. At that time was the early days where quantum wells were becoming very important. I got fascinated by the early work of Saki and Cromer. So for 10 years, I simply switched field. look at avalanche transport and so forth. But then at some point, it kind of hooked. This is a very interesting early suggestion, 1970, where Kazarin and Suri predicted that you could achieve laser action between quantum well state pumped by resonant tunneling. So to make the story short, we worked on this. This could have never been done, I claim, except maybe at Bell Labs, because we worked on it for 7 years, on and off, of course, because I was afraid otherwise that I could get fired, so I was doing also other stuff. But we had very supportive management, and at some point, just 6 months before, I was told by some manager, very famous scientist, Federico, he told my manager, actually, you should actually stop working on this. Look, enough is enough. But fortunately, there was this great buffer of very competent scientists who were all the way up. They said, no, Federico, continue to do it. And luckily, this happened in January of 1994. It worked only 90 Kelvin, low power. So the naysayers started to say, well, this will never be practical. It's nice science. We all know these familiar stories. Anyway, now they work room temperature with high power. A very interesting consequence is that you can cascade these because the electron does not annihilate with a hole. You can recycle it many times through equal stages, and therefore you can get from one electron n laser photons. And it's an example of designer laser material where you design literally everything. And I must give credit here to the pioneering work of Al Cho, who has been my collaborator at Bell Labs for over 20 years. These are cross-sections of some of the QC laser grown by Al Cho. You can see the exquisite control of layer thicknesses. This is a picture actually by another scientist at Texas A&M, what you can do with a scanning tunneling microscope to image the interfaces of this. You can see that there is a grating on top of these to select the wavelength. And in brief, just to summarize the physics, you engineer everything. This is the energy diagram. You resonantly tunnel into the excited state, and you design the population in version by making sure that the lifetime from 3 to 2 is longer than 2 to 1. And the way you ensure this is by making this energy level equal to an optical phonon resonance, to an optical phonon of 30 MeV, so this relaxation time is extremely short. You get population inversion. You want to make sure that the electrons up here don't fly away kind of horizontally here in the continuum, so you put a super lattice reflector that suppresses tunneling and allows the electron to zip through, and so forth. The lifetime are extremely short. So you see, this is why people thought it would never lace, because they told me, Federico, you can't not even make a light-emitting diode out of this because your lifetime is so short, you know. And in fact, almost no light comes out of it because the non-radiative times is orders of magnitude shorter than the radiative times. So a QC LED is something not to do, okay? But we know that once you lace, and Art Shallow used to say, I think, that everything pumped hard enough laces, once you lace, this is basically it. You can reach in the QC laser high power and so forth. And what makes interesting the agility that you can control the wavelength, but also very important, you can do ultra broadband lasing and tuning. By that I mean that you can lase in QC laser suitably designed simultaneously at all wavelengths, like say between 5 and 8 microns, and you can get large tuning. I talked about this. The ultra-fast carrier lifetime, they are overdamped. You see no relaxation or oscillation, which is interesting for semiconductor laser. And this is a very recent development, very exciting, because the negligible spontaneous emission rate compared to the lifetime, which is dominated by non-radiative process, these are parallel processes, actually, it's been recently shown, both experimentally and theoretically, the line width limit for the QC laser is actually smaller than the Charlottetown's value. This is very recently works. You can get extremely rapid frequencies in these, so you can see coherent phenomena at room temperature in these lasers, and some very interesting nonlinear optics. So this shows a device, for example, that works at 7.5 microns. These are the materials typically. And you can basically do a lot of band engineering. You can improve your population in aversion by using a two-phonon resonance. If you want, how can you get a broadband gain spectrum? Well, you can design a so-called diagonal transition in real space, you see, where you tunnel into a highly localized state, but you fan out the laser transition in very close transition over divided in many sublevels of comparable oscillator strength. And this allows you to get large gain with bandwidth and tunability. Commercialization is full swing. I've been counting every year there is a new company, and the good news is there are some major companies, some Hamamatsu, that are producing them. There is Thales somewhere and Alcatel Thales, so it's a growing list, and by both platforms. This is work I've been doing in my group with Kumar Patel, the inventor of the CO2 laser, who is producing now high-power QC laser with his company, Pranalytica. So here we have demonstrated high-power, 3 watts, continuous wave at room temperature. This is the actual product. These are used for military countermeasure. There is a major threat from shoulder-held missile. And this is a product by Pranalytica. This is a targety illuminator for the night, and so forth. And I want to talk about spectroscopy, which is probably the area of potentially greatest impact. Okay, we can operate in the 2 atmospheric windows, 3 to 5 and 8 to 13 micron, particularly if you want to measure small amount of gases, trace gases. And the way you do that is by putting a grating on the actual laser, so you have a single mode. This is known from telecom laser, and you get a so-called distributed feedback laser, which, by the way, was pioneered by Chuck Shank and Herwig Kogelnik at Bell Labs, I think in the early 70s or late 60s. This shows a single mode, 100 milliwatt peak power laser. You can see the single mode. You have to look it on a log scale. If you don't look it on the log scale, you're kind of cheating, because on the log scale, you can see if you meet the telecom standard, which are very demanding. You can only call. The telecom engineer will tell you a laser single mode if the other modes are suppressed by at least 30 decibel, because telecom is very, very tough standards. So these are widely used now to do spectroscopy. This work of Frank Tittel at Bob Curve. You can look at isotopes. This is a cooled one in particular, a 100-meter cell, because you want to look at very low concentration, some of these isotopes. This is a sensor to measure the CO concentration. This is in Houston, Texas, at a function of time. So the story is the QC laser, because of its tunability, its optical properties, and so forth, can function as a very flexible, widely tunable laser for spectroscopy. We have worked with Ford Motor Company to look at the emission from the exhaust of cars. The future, with the climate control and so forth, will call for parts per billion range certification, as opposed to the tens of parts per millions that we have now. One of the most exciting developments has been the work done by 2 leading atmospheric scientists at Harvard University, atmospheric chemistry, Professor Steve Worsley and Jim Anderson. They've flown these quantum cascade laser sensor, with the 2 in particular, in the troposphere and the actual stratosphere, and also with the robotic aircraft, the unmanned vehicle. And the key point, the key part of the story is they've been able to measure the concentration not only of the key greenhouse gases, but of other trace gases, you know, with the very high sensitivity and with extremely high precision. With extremely high precision. And in fact, you can see here, you see, this is the result of 3 years of flying up the latitude in the troposphere and in the stratosphere. You see, this is the concentration, the mixing ratio. Look at the concentration level. Look at the precision of the measurement. Why is this important? Because for making predictive models of the actual climate, we need to know with high precision the profile of all these trace gases. They tell us about the jet stream and many other things. And in fact, the QC laser have provided the first real high-resolution measurements of the vertical structure, horizontal structure of the atmosphere, and the patterns provide new information about the location and strength of greenhouse gases. So, for example, these are the altitude and latitude pattern for CO and CO2. And I want to briefly mention the ability to generate multiple wavelengths. Kind of natural, it took us years to figure out, and then we said, how come we were so slow? This is so obvious. If you stack one stack at one wavelength and another wavelength, and you run current through, provided you have designed a flat enough gain spectrum, and you can do this by band engineering, you can actually show these laser lays simultaneously over a wide spectrum, which I think is almost a unique property. These are not just much more than modes. These are widely spaced wavelengths. And you can also tune across them. So these are some of the record results for tuning, okay, of a QC laser, where you essentially put an anti-reflector cone, you parallelize the beam, and using a literal configuration, you can actually, by rotation and by translation, you can continuously tune one of these broadband gazers over 400 centimeters to the minus one. This is basically continuous tuning from 7.5 micron to 11.4 micron with the same laser. And this has been used. These type of lasers with literal configuration and grading are commercialized now by a company. Here, I want to talk about this is briefly. This type of instrument that I use, this type of tuning with a grating and so forth, have been used to monitor things such as ozone. You see, you want to detect at parts per less than part per billion. Ozone plays a key role in pollution. One of the leading users of QCL is Professor Bob Curl at Rice, world-leading spectroscopy. He was one of the trio that won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for the discovery of buckyballs. But actually, most of his activity has been in studying the radicals and other compounds. So he's been pursuing this real-time breath sensor detector. Basically, breath contains about 400 species of different trace chemicals. So here he's using, again, this commercial box here together with the acoustic driver spectroscopy to essentially analyze it in same chronicle. We have found a different approach. You see, if you have multiple gradients, there is a problem.
No.
I don't know now since
now you're back.
About the record. Yes.
You have 3 more minutes.
Yes. So basically, you see, if you try to use these gratings, movable parts, what if you want to mount your laser in an actual vehicle? It could be a military vehicle, lots of bumps in rugged terrains. That's not the best way. So with this in mind, we have studied another approach where we make an compact on-chip spectrometer. Essentially, we define in the same gain medium, the same chip, different grading periods. So now we have an array of many single mode laser, and then with an electronic controller, we can individually address each of these wavelengths, so we can do essentially broadband tuning, and we can fire them in anything we want. We can do one scan at one temperature, and we get this comb, slightly change the temperature with a thermoelectric cooler, and if we have designed properly this laser spacing, we can actually get continuous tuning. And so this is our box that my students made. So our idea is we want to make a compact spectrometer that we can be moved around with high brightness. So we can compete directly with Fourier transform interferometers, which use thermal sources. Of course, they won't have the same bandwidth, but we should be able to detect trace gases and do a spectroscopy at many miles away, because a laser typically QCL, you know, four orders of magnitude higher brightness than a thermal source used for Fourier transform interferometer. This shows the kind of, these are all single mode laser, you know, 20 different that cover 200 centimeter to the minus one. And this shows comparing our data with those of a state-of-the-art Fourier transform interferometer, that are the spectra of liquids. They compare very favorably. This is the most recent review on QCL. It was primary auto Bob Curve, quantum cascade laser in chemical physics. And they become probably one of the most useful sources of mid-IR radiation. In the terahertz, I really don't have time. The story is it's very hard yet to approach TE cooler temperature. If we can achieve TE cooler, this will be a major breakthrough. We are inching close. We have to design, first of all, very different waveguide, because how can you fit a 200 micron wavelength within tens of micron of material? You cannot use a dielectric waveguide. So we have used a metal, semiconductor metal waveguide. That solves the problem. And these are you see, we are getting close to 200K, but not quite, using a similar concept. And so what we are trying to beat, it might be very difficult to achieve a room temperature, almost impossible at TRL, so we are trying to beat it by using intracavity nonlinear optics. So we have made a QCL which generates two powerful mid-IR beams, and then designing inside an optical nonlinearity so we can get a terahertz beat at the difference frequency. So now omega 1 and omega 2, these are room temperature laser, simultaneous lasing. So we hope to be able to make soon a reasonable power mid-infrared terahertz source at room temperature. We did a demonstration. We are still quite far away, but the numbers are in our favor. This is the spectrum of a 70 micron wavelengths, which is obtained by beating of two mid-IR lasers. We are 0.3 microwatts at room temperature. Calculations say we should be able to get relatively straightforward 100 micron by improving many things, getting phase matching better, and so forth. And so we are hopeful that this is an approach. What does the future bring us? The large design potential still has to be exhausted. There are so many enormous combinations that, in fact, some people are starting to use these genetic algorithms to try to find local minimal, because there's continuously a new surprise every year or so. There is a new structure, and people think, why didn't I think about it? Well, partly because there are so many variable. Wide range of chemical sensing application and high power. The efficiency right now, you see, we have achieved now 15% power efficiency. We are going from, we are aiming at 30%. And the short wavelength is a challenge to achieve higher performance than 3 micron, and to achieve high performance at in the actual terahertz. Telecom wavelengths is very interesting. If we can make QCLs with nitrides, the simulations are spectacular. It shows that you can essentially make a laser almost completely insensitive to temperature without chirp and high speed. It looks great on paper, and of course it's going to take years before someone can make a QCL at telecom. This is one of the most exciting frontier to do mode locking, pulse shaping, and mid-infrared combs. I think will open a new frontier in molecular spectroscopy and coherent control. Long way to go. We just got the mode locking to work last year. And finally, which I had no time, there is a new frontier that you can increase the functionality of the laser using plasmolic and metamaterial. So semiconductor has been very fruitful for laser. Certainly, I think they're made out of semiconductor laser most impactful from a commercial point of view. And there are a good story of synergy between solid-state physics, you know, quantum mechanics, optics, photonics, and I think the story will continue to many years to come. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Let me ask if there are any questions or comments. I am struck by the fact that these lasers are now so widely used. How much of your effort has actually been devoted to, you know, to getting them out there?
Well, I mean, that was the again you asked, because I remember when I was at Bell Labs after 2 years when we were at a room temperature, I told my professor, I said, now what we're going to do next is no one had yet demonstrated them. In fact, there was even some people who were, this is why I'm not worried, because when it lasers, you know, and then you put a match on front and light it up, that lasers. But, you know, how come no one else? And it took about, after 5 years, we were really kind of ahead of the game. And in the meantime, I decided to give them to about 50, 60 groups worldwide. And because I said, I want them to tell the good story, not to me. And that was good. And at Harvard, I'm continuing also pushing, the commercialization and so forth, because I think history shows, you know, that you need to push both the science and the technology. And so that's the answer.
So can we look forward to high-resolution pictures of us naked as we go onto airplanes?
I'm not so sure that I look forward to it, but that's one of, I didn't mention it, but that's one of the applications that is being touted. But for that, of course, we need to make it a tea cooler. You know, unless we make it tea cooled, you know. So that's the challenge.
Good luck on that.
I don't think that will make us popular.
Well, thank you very much.